taxes. Life was good, you remember? It'll take a year to crank up that treadmill, but we can do it. We have no choice. We'll survive until the appeals run their course. If the verdict stands, Kirkhead can take his money and take a hike. We'll retire. Time for the sailboat. If the verdict is reversed, we'll go bankrupt and start advertising for quickie divorces. Surely the verdict will attract clients. Of course, but most of it'll be junk. By using the word bankrupt, Wes had gently placed Huffy back in his box, along with old Prickhead and the bank. The verdict could not be classified as an asset, and without it, the Paytons' balance sheet looked as bleak as it did a day earlier. They had lost virtually everything already, and to be adjudged bankrupt was a further indignity they were willing to endure. Pile it on. They would be back. I'm not giving you a plan, Huffy. Thanks for asking. Come back in 30 days and we'll talk. Right now I've got clients who have been ignored for months.
So what do I tell Mr. Prickhead?
Simple. Push just a little bit harder and he can use the paper to wipe with. Ease off, give us some time, and we'll satisfy the debt.
I'll pass it along.
At Babe's Coffee Shop on Main Street, Mary Grace and Tip Shepherd sat in a booth near the front windows and talked about the town. She remembered Main Street as a busy place where people shopped and gathered. Bowmore was too small for the large discount stores, so the downtown merchants survived. When she was a kid, traffic was often heavy, parking hard to find. Now half the storefronts were covered with plywood, and the other half were desperate for business. A teenager with an apron brought two cups of black coffee and left without a word. Mary Grace added sugar while Shepherd watched her carefully.
Are you sure the coffee is safe? He asked.
Of course. The city finally passed an ordinance forbidding the use of its water in restaurants. Plus, I've known Babe for 30 years. She was one of the first to buy her water. Shepherd took a cautious sip, then arranged his tape recorder and notebook.
Why did you take the cases? He asked.
She smiled and shook her head and kept stirring. I've asked myself that 1,000 times, but the answer's really simple. Pete, Jeanette's husband, worked for my uncle. I knew several of the victims. It's a small town, and when so many people became ill, it was obvious there had to be a reason. The cancer came in waves, and there was so much suffering. After attending the first 3 or 4 funerals, I realized something had to be done. He took notes and ignored the pause. She continued, Crane was the biggest employer, and for years there had been rumors of dumping around the plant. A lot of folks who worked there got sick. I remember coming home from college after my sophomore year and hearing people talk about how bad the water was. We lived a mile outside of town and had our own well, so it was never a problem for us. But things got worse in town. Over the years, the rumors of dumping grew and grew until everyone came to believe them. At the same time, the water turned into a putrid liquid that was undrinkable. Then the cancer hit. Liver, kidney, urinary tract, stomach, bladder, lots of leukemia. I was in church one Sunday with my parents, and I could see 4 slick, shiny, bald heads. Chemo. I thought I was in a horror movie.
Have you regretted the litigation?
No, never. We've lost a lot, but then so has my hometown. Hopefully the losing is over now. Wes and I are young. We'll survive. But many of these folks are either dead or deathly ill.
Do you think about the money?
What money? The appeal will take 18 months, and right now that seems like an eternity. You have to see the big picture.
Which is?
5 years from now. In 5 years, the toxic dump will be cleaned up and gone forever, and no one will ever be hurt by it again. There will be a settlement, one big massive settlement where Crane Chemical and its insurers are finally brought to the table with their very deep pockets and are forced to compensate the families they have ruined. Everybody gets their share of the damages.
Including the lawyers.
Absolutely. If not for the lawyers, Crane would still be here manufacturing Pillamar 5 and dumping its byproducts in the pits behind the plant, and no one could hold them accountable.
Instead, they are now in Mexico,
Oh, yes, manufacturing Pellemar 5 and dumping its byproducts in pits behind the plants, and nobody gives a damn. They don't have these trials down there.
What are your chances on appeal?
She sipped the stale and heavily sugared coffee and was about to answer when an insurance agent stopped by, shook her hand, hugged her, said thanks several times, and appeared to be on the verge of tears when he walked away. Then Mr. Greenwood, her junior high principal, now retired, spotted her as he entered and practically crushed her in a bear hug. He ignored Shepard while rambling on about how proud he was of her. He thanked her, promised to keep praying for her, asked about her family, and so on. As he withdrew in a windy farewell, Babe, the owner, came over for a hug and another lengthy round of congratulations. Shepard finally stood and eased out the door. A few minutes later, Mary Grace made her exit. "Sorry about that," she said. "It's a big moment for the town."
"They are very proud."
"Let's go see the plant." The Crane Chemical Beaumont Plant No. 2, as it was officially known, was in an abandoned industrial park on the east side of the city limits. The plant was a series of flat-roofed, cinder-block buildings connected by massive piping and conveyors. Water towers and storage silos rose behind the buildings. Everything was overgrown with kudzu and weeds. Because of the litigation, the company had secured the facility with miles of 12-foot chain-link fencing, topped with glistening razor wire. Heavy gates were chained and padlocked. Like a prison where bad things happened, the plant shut out the world and kept its secrets buried within. Mary Grace had visited the plant at least a dozen times during the litigation, but always with a mob, other lawyers, engineers, former Crane employees, security guards, even Judge Harrison. The last visit had been 2 months earlier when the jurors were given a tour. She and Shepard stopped at the main gate and examined the padlocks. A large decaying sign identified the plant and its owner. As they stared through the chain-link fence, Mary Grace said, "6 years ago, when it became apparent that litigation was inevitable, Crane fled to Mexico. The employees were given 3 days' notice and $500 in severance pay. Many of them had worked here for 30 years. It was an incredibly stupid way to leave town because some of their former workers were our best witnesses during the trial. The bitterness was and is astounding. If Crane had any friends in Beaumont, it lost every one of them when it screwed its employees." A photographer working with Shepard met them at the front gate and began snapping away. They strolled along the fence with Mary Grace directing the brief tour. "For years, this place was unlocked. It was routinely vandalized. Teenagers hung out here, drinking and doing drugs. Now people stay as far away as possible. The gates and fences are really not needed. No one wants to get near this place." From the north side, a long row of thick metal cylinders was visible in the midst of the plant. Mary Grace pointed and explained, "That's known as Extraction Unit 2. The bichloroniline was reduced as a byproduct and stored in those tanks. From there, some was shipped away for a proper disposal, but most was taken into the woods there, farther back on the property, and simply dumped into a ravine."
"Proctor's pit?"
"Yes. Mr. Proctor was the supervisor in charge of disposal. He died of cancer before we could subpoena him." They walked 20 yards along the fence. "We really can't see from here, but there are three ravines in there, deep in the woods, where they simply hauled the tanks and covered them with dirt and mud. Over the years, they began to leak. They were not even sealed properly, and the chemicals soaked into the earth. This went on for years. Tons and tons of bichloroniline and Cartilix and Achlor and other proven carcinogens. If you can believe our experts, and the jury evidently did, the poisons finally contaminated the aquifer from which Beaumont pumps its water." A security detail in a golf cart approached on the other side of the fence. Two overweight guards with guns stopped and stared.
"Just ignore them," Mary Grace whispered.
"What are you looking for?"
a guard asked. "We're on the right side of the fence," she answered.
"What are you looking for?"
he repeated. "I'm Mary Grace Payton, one of the attorneys. You boys move along." Both nodded at once, and then slowly drove away. She glanced at her watch. I really need to be going. When can we meet again?
We'll see. No promises. Things are quite hectic right now.
They drove back to the Pine Grove Church and said goodbye. When Shepherd was gone, Mary Grace walked 3 blocks to Jeanette's trailer. Betty was at work. The place was quiet. For an hour, she sat with her client under a small tree and drank bottled lemonade. No tears, no tissues, just girl talk about life and families and the past 4 months together in that awful courtroom. Chapter 6. With an hour to go before trading closed, Crane bottomed at $18 a share, then began a rather feeble rally, if it could be called that. It nibbled around $20 a share for half an hour before finding some traction at that price. To add to the catastrophe, investors for some reason chose to exact revenge on the rest of Carl's empire. His Trudeau Group owned 45% of Crane and smaller chunks of 6 other public companies, 3 chemical companies, an oil exploration firm, an auto parts maker, and a chain of hotels. Shortly after lunch, the common shares of the other 6 began slipping as well. It made no sense whatsoever, but then the market often cannot be explained. Misery is contagious on Wall Street. Panic is common and rarely understood. Mr. Trudeau did not see the chain reaction coming, nor did Felix Bard, his savvy financial wizard. As the minutes dragged by, they watched in horror as $1 billion in market value slipped away from the Trudeau Group. Blame was rampant. Obviously, it all went back to the verdict in Mississippi, but many analysts, especially the babbling experts on cable, made much of the fact that Crane Chemical had for years chosen to go brazenly forward without the benefit of full liability insurance. The company had saved a fortune in premiums, but was now giving it back in spades. Bobby Ratzlaff was listening to one such analyst on a television in a corner when Carl snapped, "Turn that thing off." It was almost 4 p.m., the magic hour when the exchange closed and the bloodshed ended. Carl was at his desk, phone stuck to his head. Bard was at the conference table watching 2 monitors and recording the latest stock prices. Ratzlaff was pale and sick and even more bankrupt than before, and he went from window to window as if selecting the one for his final flight. The other 6 stocks rallied at the final buzzer, and though they were down significantly, the damage was not ruinous. The companies were solid performers, and their stocks would readjust themselves in due course. Crane, on the other hand, was a train wreck. It closed at $21.25, a full $31.25 collapse since the day before. Its market value had shrunk from $3.2 billion to $1.3 billion. Mr. Trudeau's 45% share of the misery was about $850 million. Bard quickly added the declines from the other 6 companies and computed a one-day loss for his boss at $1.1 billion. Not a record, but probably enough to land Carl on someone's top 10 list. After a review of the closing numbers, Carl ordered Bard and Ratzlaff to put on their jackets, straighten their ties, and follow him. 4 floors below in the corporate offices of Crane Chemical, its top executives were hunkered down in a small dining room reserved exclusively for themselves. The food was notoriously bland, but the view was impressive. Lunch had not been important that day. No one had an appetite. They had been waiting for an hour, shell-shocked and expecting an explosion from above. A mass funeral would have been a livelier event. But Mr. Trudeau managed to brighten up the room. He marched purposefully in, his 2 minions in tow, Bard with a plastic grin, Ratzlaff green at the gills, and instead of yelling, thanked the men, all boys, for their hard work and commitment to the company. A wide smile, and Carl said, "Gentlemen, this is not a very good day, one which I'm sure we'll remember for a long time." His voice was pleasant, just another friendly little drop-in from the man at the top. But today is now over, thankfully, and we are still standing. Tomorrow, we start kicking ass. A few nervous looks, maybe a smile or two. Most were expecting to be sacked on the spot. He continued, "I want you to remember three things that I'm about to say on this historic occasion. First, no one in this room is losing his job. Second, Crane Chemical will survive this miscarriage of justice. And third, I do not intend to lose this fight." He was the epitome of the confident leader, the captain rallying his troops in their foxholes. A victory sign and long cigar, and he could have been Churchill in his finest hour. He ordered chins up, backs to the wall, and so on. Even Bobby Ratzlaff began to feel better. 2 hours later, Ratzlaff and Bard were finally dismissed and sent home. Carl wanted time to reflect, to lick his wounds, to clear his head. To help matters, he fixed himself a scotch and took off his shoes. The sun was setting somewhere beyond New Jersey, and he said good riddance to such an unforgettable day. He glanced at his computer and checked the day's phone calls. Brianna had called 4 times, nothing urgent. If she had an important matter, Carl's secretary logged it as "your wife" and not Brianna. He'd call her later. He was in no mood for the summary of her daily workouts. There were over 40 calls, and number 28 caught his attention. Senator Grott had checked in from Washington. Carl barely knew him personally, but every serious corporate player knew of the senator. Grott had served 3 terms in the U.S. Senate from New York before he retired voluntarily and joined a powerful law firm to make his fortune. He was Mr. Washington, the ultimate insider, the seasoned counselor and advisor, with offices on Wall Street, Pennsylvania Avenue, and anywhere else he chose. Senator Grott had more contacts than anyone, often golfed with whoever happened to occupy the White House, traveled the world in search of more contacts, offered advice only to the powerful, and was generally regarded as the top connection between big corporate America and big government. If the senator called, you called him back, even though you'd just lost $1 billion. The senator knew exactly how much you had lost and was concerned about it. Carl dialed the private number. After 8 rings, a gruff voice said, "Grott." "Senator Grott, Carl Trudeau here," Carl said politely. He was deferential to very few people, but the senator demanded and deserved respect. "Oh, yes, Carl," came the reply as if they had played golf many times. "Just a couple of old pals." Carl heard the voice and thought of the countless times he'd seen the senator on the news. "How is Amos?" he asked. The contact, the name that linked both men to this call. "Great. Had lunch with him last month." A lie. Amos was the managing partner of the corporate law firm Carl had been using for a decade. Not the senator's firm, not even close. But Amos was a substantial person, certainly big enough to be mentioned by the senator. "Give him my regards."
"Certainly. Now get on with it," Carl was thinking.
"Listen, I know it's been a long day, so I won't keep you."
A pause.
"There is a man in Boca Raton that you should see. Name is Reinhardt, Barry Reinhardt. He's a consultant of sorts, though you'll never find him in the phone book. His firm specializes in elections."
A long pause, and Carl had to say something, so he said,
"Okay, I'm listening." "He is extremely competent, smart, discreet, successful, and expensive. And if anyone can fix this verdict, Mr. Reinhardt is your man."
"Fix this verdict?" Carl repeated. The senator continued,
"If you're interested, I'll give him a call. Open the door."
"Well, yes, I'd certainly be interested."
"Fix the verdict? It was music." "Good. I'll be in touch."
"Thank you." And with that, the conversation was over. So typical of the senator. A favor here, the payback there. All contacts running to and fro, everybody's back getting properly scratched. The call was free, But one day, the senator would be paid. Carl stirred his scotch with a finger and looked at the rest of his calls. Nothing but misery. Fix this verdict? He kept repeating. In the center of his immaculate desk was a memo marked confidential. Weren't all of his memos confidential? On the cover sheet, someone had scrawled with a black marker the name Peyton. Carl picked it up, arranged both feet on his desk, and flipped through it. There were photos. The first from yesterday's trial when Mr. and Mrs. Peyton were leaving the courthouse, walking hand in hand in glorious triumph. There was an earlier one of Mary Grace from a bar publication with a quick bio. Born in Bowmore, college at Millsaps, law school at Ole Miss, 2 years in a federal clerkship, 2 in a public defender's office, past president of the County Bar Association, certified trial lawyer, school board, member of the state Democratic Party, and a few tree hugger groups. From the same publication, a photo and bio of James Wesley Peyton, born in Monroe, Louisiana, lettered in football at Southern Miss, law school at Tulane, 3 years as an assistant prosecutor, member of all the available trial lawyer groups, Rotary Club, Civitan, and so on. 2 backwater ambulance chasers who had just orchestrated Carl's exit from the Forbes 400 list of the richest Americans. 2 children, an illegal nanny, public schools, Episcopal Church, near foreclosures on both home and office, near repossessions of 2 automobiles, a law practice, no other partners, just support staff, that was now 10 years old and was once fairly profitable by small-town standards, but now sought refuge in an abandoned dime store where the rent was at least 3 months in arrears. And then the good part. Heavy debts, at least $400,000 to Second State Bank on a line of credit that is basically unsecured. No payments, not even on the interest in 5 months. Second State Bank was a local outfit with 10 offices in South Mississippi. $400,000 borrowed for the sole purpose of financing the lawsuit against Crane Chemical.
$400,000, Carl mumbled.
So far, he'd paid almost $14 million to defend the damn thing. Bank accounts are empty, credit cards no longer in use, other clients, non-Bowmore variety, rumored to be frustrated by lack of attention. No other substantial verdicts to speak of, nothing close to $1 million. Summary. These people are heavily in debt and hanging on by their fingernails. A little push, and they're over the edge. Strategy. Drag out the appeals. Delay, delay. Crank up pressure from the bank. Possible buyout of Second State, then call the loan. Bankruptcy would be the only course. Huge distraction as appeals rage on. Also, Peytons would be unable to pursue their other 30 or so cases versus Crane and would probably decline more clients. Bottom line, this little law firm can be destroyed. The memo was unsigned, which was no surprise, but Carl knew it was written by one of 2 hatchet men working in Ratzlaff's office. He'd find out which one and give the boy a raise. Good work. The great Carl Trudeau had dismantled large conglomerates, taken over hostile boards of directors, fired celebrity CEOs, upset entire industries, fleeced bankers, manipulated stock prices, and destroyed the careers of dozens of his enemies. He could certainly ruin a garden variety mom-and-pop law firm in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Tolliver delivered him home shortly after 9 p.m., a time selected by Carl because Sadler would be in bed and he would not be forced to dote on a child he had no interest in. The other child could not be avoided. Brianna was waiting dutifully for him. They would dine by the fire. When he walked through the door, he came face to face with Imelda, already permanently ensconced in the foyer and looking more abused than the night before. He couldn't help but gawk at the sculpture. Did the pile of brass rods really resemble a young girl? Where was the torso?
Where were the limbs? Where was her head? Had he really paid that much money for such an abstract mess? And how long might she haunt him in his own penthouse? As his valet took his coat and briefcase, Carl stared sadly at his masterpiece, then heard the dreaded words, "Hello, darling." Brianna swept into the room, a flowing red gown trailing after her. They pecked cheeks. "Isn't it stunning?" she gushed, flopping an arm at Imelda. "Stunning is the word," he said. He looked at Brianna, then he looked at Imelda, and he wanted to choke both of them. But the moment passed. He could never admit defeat. "Dinner is ready, darling," she cooed.
"I'm not hungry. Let's have a drink."
"But Claudel has fixed your favorite grilled sole."
"No appetite, dear," he said, yanking off his tie and tossing it to his valet.
"Today was awful, I know," she said. "A scotch?"
"Yes."
"Will you tell me about it?" she asked.
"I'd love to."
Brianna's private money manager, a woman unknown to Carl, had called throughout the day with updates on the collapse. Brianna knew the numbers, and she had heard the reports that her husband was down $1 billion or so. She dismissed the kitchen staff, then changed into a much more revealing nightgown. They met by the fire and chatted until he fell asleep. Chapter 7. At 10 a.m. Friday, 2 days post-verdict, the Peyton firm met in the pit, a large open space with unpainted sheetrock walls, lined with homemade bookshelves, and cluttered with a heavy collage of aerial photos, medical summaries, juror profiles, expert witness reports, and 100 other trial documents and exhibits. In the center of the room was a table of sorts, 4 large pieces of inch-thick plywood mounted on sawhorses and surrounded with a sad collection of metal and wooden chairs, almost all of which were missing a piece or two. The table had obviously been the center of the storm for the past 4 months, with piles of papers and stacks of law books. Sherman, a paralegal, had spent most of the previous day hauling out coffee cups, pizza boxes, Chinese food containers, and empty water bottles. He had also swept the concrete floors, though no one could tell. Their previous office, a 3-story building on Main Street, had been beautifully decorated, well-appointed, and spruced up each night by a cleaning service. Appearance and neatness were important back then. Now, they were just trying to survive. In spite of the dismal surroundings, the mood was light, and for obvious reasons. The marathon was over. The incredible verdict was still hard to believe. United by sweat and hardship, the tight-knit little firm had taken on the beast and won a big one for the good guys. Mary Grace called the meeting to order. The phones were put on hold because Tabby, the receptionist, was very much a part of the firm and was expected to participate in the discussion. Thankfully, the phones were beginning to ring again. Sherman and Rusty, the other paralegal, wore jeans, sweatshirts, no socks. Working in what was once a dime store, who could care about a dress code? Tabby and Vicky, the other receptionist, had abandoned nice clothes when both snagged dresses on the hand-me-down furniture. Only Olivia, the matronly bookkeeper, turned herself out each day in proper office attire. They sat around the plywood table sipping the same bad coffee they were now addicted to and listened with smiles as Mary Grace did her recap. "There will be the usual post-trial motion," she was saying. "Judge Harrison has scheduled a hearing in 30 days, but we expect no surprises."
"Here's to Judge Harrison," Sherman said, and they toasted him with their coffee.
It had become a very democratic firm. Everyone present felt like an equal. Anyone could speak whenever he or she felt like it. Only first names were used. Poverty is a great equalizer. Mary Grace continued. "For the next few months, Sherman and I will handle the Baker case as it moves forward, and we will keep the other Bowmore cases current. Wes and Rusty will take everything else and start generating some cash."
Applause. "Here's to cash," Sherman said, another toast.
He possessed a law degree from a night school, but had not been able to pass the bar exam. He was now in his mid-40s, a career paralegal who knew more law than most lawyers. Rusty was 20 years younger and contemplating med school. "While we're on the subject," Mary Grace continued, "Olivia has given me the latest red ink summary. Always a pleasure." She picked up a sheet of paper and looked at the numbers. "We are now officially 3 months behind in rent for a total of $4,500.
"Oh, please evict us," Rusty said.
"But the landlord is still our client, and he's not worried. All other bills are at least 2 months past due, except, of course, the phones and electricity. Salaries have not been paid in 4 weeks."
"Five,"
Sherman said.
"Are you sure?"
she asked.
"As of today. Today is payday, or at least it used to be."
"Sorry. 5 weeks past due. We should have some cash in a week if we can settle the Rainey case. We'll try to catch up."
"We're surviving,"
Tabby said. She was the only single person in the firm. All others had spouses with jobs. Though budgets were painfully tight, they were determined to survive.
"How about the Payton family?"
Vicky asked. "We're fine," Wes said. "I know you're concerned, thank you, but we're getting by just like you. I've said this 100 times, but I'll say it again. Mary Grace and I will pay you as soon as we possibly can. Things are about to improve."
"We're more concerned about you," Mary Grace added.
No one was leaving. No one was threatening. A deal had been struck long ago, though it was not in writing. If and when the Bowmore case is paid off, the money would be shared by the entire firm. Maybe not equally, but everyone present knew they would be rewarded.
"How about the bank?" Rusty asked.
There were no secrets now. They knew Huffy had stopped by the day before, and they knew how much Second State Bank was owed. "I stiff-armed the bank," Wes said. "If they push a little more, then we'll file Chapter 11 and screw them."
"I vote screw the bank,"
Sherman said. It seemed to be unanimous around the room that the bank should get screwed, though everyone knew the truth. The lawsuit would not have been possible without Huffy's lobbying on their behalf and convincing Mr. Prickhead to raise the line of credit. They also knew that the Paytons would not rest until the bank was paid.
"We should clear $12,000 from the Rainey case," Mary Grace said, "and another $10,000 from the dog bite."
"Maybe $15,000, Wes said.
"Then what? Where's the next settlement?"
Mary Grace threw this on the table for all to consider.
"Gita?"
Sherman said it was more of a suggestion. Wes looked at Mary Grace. Both gave blank looks to Sherman.
"Who's Gita?"
"Gita happens to be a client. Slip and fall at the Kroger store. Came in about 8 months ago."
There were some odd glances around the table. It was obvious that the two lawyers had forgotten one of their clients.
"I don't recall that one," Wes admitted.
"What's the potential?" Mary Grace asked.
"Not much. Shaky liability, maybe $20,000. I'll review the file with you on Monday."
"Good idea," Mary Grace said, and quickly moved on to something else. "I know the phones are ringing, and we are definitely broke, but we are not about to start taking a bunch of junk. No real estate or bankruptcies. No criminal cases unless they can pay the freight. No contested divorces. We'll do the quickies for $1,000, but everything must be agreed on. This is a personal injury firm, and if we get loaded down with the small stuff, we won't have time for the good cases. Any questions?"
"There's a lot of weird stuff coming in by phone," Tabby said, "and from all over the country."
"Just stick to the basics," Wes said. "We can't handle cases in Florida or Seattle. We need quick settlements here at home, at least for the next 12 months.
"How long will the appeals take?"
Vicky asked.
18 to 24 months, Mary Grace answered. "And there's not much we can do to push things along. It's a process, and that's why it's important to hunker down now and generate some fees elsewhere."
"Which brings up another point," Wes said. "The verdict changes the landscape dramatically. First, expectations are through the roof right now, and our other Bowmore clients will soon be pestering us. They want their day in court, their big verdict. We must be patient, but we can't let these people drive us crazy. Second, the vultures are descending on Bowmore. Lawyers will be chasing one another looking for clients. It will be a free-for-all. Any contact from another attorney is to be reported immediately. Third, the verdict places even greater pressure on Crane. Their dirty tricks will get even dirtier. They have people watching us. Trust no one. Speak to no one. Nothing leaves this office. All papers are shredded. As soon as we can afford it, we'll hire nighttime security. Bottom line, watch everyone and watch your backs.
This is fun, Vicky said. Like a movie.
Any questions?
Yes, Rusty said. Can Sherman and I start chasing ambulances again? It's been 4 months, you know, since the beginning of the trial. I really miss the excitement.
I haven't seen the inside of an ER in weeks, Sherman added. And I miss the sounds of the sirens. It wasn't clear if they were joking or not, but the moment was humorous and good for a laugh. Mary Grace finally said, I really don't care what you do. I just don't want to know everything.
Meeting adjourned, Wes said. And it's Friday. Everyone has to leave at noon. We're locking the doors. See you Monday.
They picked up Mac and Liza from school, and after fast food for lunch, they headed south through the countryside for an hour until they saw the first sign for Lake Garland. The roads narrowed before finally turning to gravel. The cabin was at the dead end of a dirt trail, perched above the water on stilts and wedged into a tight spot where the woods met the shoreline. A short pier ran from the porch into the water, and beyond it, the vast lake seemed to stretch for miles. There was no other sign of human activity, either on the lake or anywhere around it. The cabin was owned by a lawyer friend in Hattiesburg, a man Wes had once worked for and who had declined to get involved in the Bowmore mess. That decision had seemed a wise one until about 48 hours ago. Now there was considerable doubt. The original idea had been to drive a few more hours to Destin and have a long weekend on the beach, but they simply couldn't afford it. They unloaded the car as they roamed through the spacious cabin, an A-frame with a huge loft, which Mac surveyed and declared perfect for another night of camping out. We'll see, Wes said. There were three small bedrooms on the main level, and he planned to find a comfortable bed. Serious sleep was the goal for the weekend. Sleep and time with the kids. As promised, the fishing gear was in a storage room under the porch. The boat was winched at the end of the pier, and the children watched with anticipation as Wes lowered it into the water. Mary Grace fiddled with the life jackets and made sure both kids were properly secured. An hour after they arrived, she was tucked away comfortably under a quilt in a lounge chair on the porch, book in hand, watching the rest of her family inch across the blue horizon of Lake Garland, three small silhouettes in search of brim and crappie. It was mid-November, and red and yellow leaves were falling, twisting in the breeze and covering the cabin, the pier, and the water around it. There were no sounds. The small boat motor was too far away. The wind was too soft. The birds and wildlife were elsewhere for the moment. Perfect stillness. A rare event in any life, but one that she especially treasured now. She closed the book, closed her eyes, and tried to think of something unrelated to the past few months. Where would they be in 5 years? She concentrated on the future because the past was thoroughly consumed by the Baker case. They would certainly be in a house, though never again would they hock their future with a fat mortgage on a showy little castle in the suburbs. She wanted a home, nothing more. She no longer cared about imported cars and an expensive office and all the other toys that once seemed so important. She wanted to be a mother to her children, and she wanted a home to raise them in. Family and assets aside, she wanted more lawyers. Their firm would be larger and full of smart and talented lawyers who did nothing but pursue the creators of toxic dumps and bad drugs and defective products. One day, Peyton and Peyton would be known not for the cases it won, but for the crooks it hauled into court for judgment. She was 41 years old, and she was tired. But the fatigue would pass. The old dreams of full-time motherhood and a cushy retirement were forever forgotten. Crane Chemical had converted her into a radical and a crusader. After the last 4 months, she would never be the same. Enough. Her eyes were wide open. Every thought took her back to the case, to Jeanette Baker, the trial, Crane Chemical. She would not spend this quiet and lovely weekend dwelling on such matters. She opened her book and started to read. For dinner, they roasted hot dogs and marshmallows over a stone pit near the water, then sat on the pier in the darkness and watched the stars. The air was clear and cool, and they huddled together under a quilt. A distant light flickered on the horizon, and after some discussion, it was agreed upon that it was just a boat.
"Dad, tell us a story,"
Max said. He was squeezed between his sister and his mother. "What kind of story?"
"A ghost story. A scary one."
His first thought was about the dogs of Beaumont. For years, a pack of stray dogs had roamed the outskirts of the town. Often in the dead of night, they shrieked and yelped and made more noise than a pack of coyotes. Legend held that the dogs were rabid and had been driven crazy because they drank the water. But he'd had enough of Beaumont. He remembered one about a ghost who walked on water in the night, looking for his beloved wife who had drowned. He began to tell it, and the children squeezed closer to their parents. Chapter 8. A uniformed guard opened the gates to the mansion, then nodded smartly to the driver as the long black Mercedes rushed by, in a hurry as always. Mr. Carl Trudeau had the rear seat alone, already lost in the morning's papers. It was 7:30 a.m., too early for golf or tennis, and too early for Saturday morning traffic in Palm Beach. Within minutes, the car was on Interstate 95, racing south. Carl ignored the market reports. Thank God the week was finally over. Crane closed at $19.50 the day before and showed no signs of finding a permanent floor. Though he would be forever known as one of the very few men who had lost $1 billion in a day, he was already plotting his next legend. Give him a year, and he'd have his billion back. In 2 years, he'd double all of it. 40 minutes later, he was in Boca Raton, crossing the waterway, headed for the clusters of high-rise condos and hotels packed along the beach. The office building was a shiny glass cylinder, 10 floors tall, with a gate and a guard, and not one word posted on a sign of any type. The Mercedes was waved through and stopped under a portico. A stern-faced young man in a black suit opened the rear door and said, "Good morning, Mr. Trudeau." "Good morning," Carl said and climbed out. "This way, sir." According to Carl's hasty research, the firm of Troy Hogan worked very hard at not being seen. It had no website, brochure, advertisements, listed phone numbers, or anything else that might attract clients. It was not a law firm because it was not registered with the state of Florida, or any other state for that matter. It had no registered lobbyists. It was a corporation, not a limited partnership or some other variety of association. It was unclear where the name originated because there was no record of anyone named Troy or Hogan. The firm was known to provide marketing and consulting services, but there was no clue as to the nature of this business. It was domiciled in Bermuda and had been registered in Florida for 8 years. Its domestic agent was a law firm in Miami. It was privately owned, and no one knew who owned it. The less Carl learned about the firm, the more he admired it. The principal was one Barry Reinhardt, and here the trail grew somewhat warmer. According to friends and contacts in Washington, Reinhardt had passed through D.C. 20 years earlier without leaving a fingerprint. He had worked for a congressman, the Pentagon, and a couple of mid-sized lobbying outfits, the typical resume of a million others. He left town for no apparent reason in 1990 and surfaced in Minnesota, where he ran the successful campaign of a political unknown who got elected to Congress. Then he went to Oregon, where he worked his magic in a Senate race. As his reputation began to rise, he abruptly quit doing campaigns and disappeared altogether. End of trail. Reinhardt was 48 years old, married and divorced twice, no children, no criminal record, no professional associations, no civic clubs. He had a degree in political science from the University of Maryland and a law degree from the University of Nevada. No one seemed to know what he was doing now, but he was certainly doing it well. His suite on the top floor of the Cylinder was beautifully decorated with minimalist contemporary art and furniture. Carl, who spared no expense with his own office, was impressed. Barry was waiting at the door of his office. The two shook hands and exchanged the usual pleasantries as they took in the details of the other's suit, shirt, tie, shoes. Nothing off the rack, no detail left undone, even though it was a Saturday morning in South Florida. Impressions were crucial, especially to Barry, who was thrilled at the prospect of snaring a new and substantial client. Carl had half expected a slick car salesman with a bad suit, but he was pleasantly surprised. Mr. Reinhardt was dignified, soft-spoken, well-groomed, and very much at ease in the presence of such a powerful man. He was certainly not an equal, but he seemed to be comfortable with this. A secretary asked about coffee as they stepped inside and met the ocean. From the 10th floor beachside, the Atlantic stretched forever. Carl, who gazed at the Hudson River several times a day, was envious. "Beautiful," he said, staring from the row of 10-foot glass windows. "Not a bad place to work," Barry said. They settled into beige leather chairs as the coffee arrived. The secretary closed the door behind her, giving the place a nice, secure feel. "I appreciate you meeting me on a Saturday morning, and with such short notice," Carl said. "The pleasure is mine," Barry said. "It's been a rough week." "I've had better. I take it you've spoken personally with Senator Grott." "Oh, yes. We chat occasionally. He was very vague about your firm and what you do." Barry laughed and crossed his legs. "We do campaigns. Have a look." He picked up a remote and pushed the button, and a large white screen dropped from the ceiling and covered most of a wall. Then the entire nation appeared. Most of the states were in green. The rest were in a soft yellow. 39 states elect their appellate and Supreme Court judges. They are in green. The yellow ones have the good sense to appoint their courts. We make our living in the green ones.
Judicial elections?
Yes, that's all we do, and we do it very quietly. When our clients need help, we target a Supreme Court justice who is not particularly friendly, and we take him or her out of the picture.
Just like that.
Just like that.
Who are your clients?
I can't give you names, but they're all on your side of the street. Big companies in energy, insurance, pharmaceuticals, chemicals, timber, all types of manufacturers, plus doctors, hospitals, nursing homes, banks. We raise tons of money and hire the people on the ground to run aggressive campaigns.
Have you worked in Mississippi?
Not yet. Barry punched another button, and America was back. The green states slowly turned black. The darker states are the ones we've worked in. As you can see, they're coast to coast. We maintain a presence in all 39.
Carl took some coffee and nodded as if he wanted Barry to keep talking.
We employ about 50 people here. The entire building is ours, and we accumulate enormous amounts of data. Information is power, and we know everything. We review every appellate decision in the green states. We know every appellate judge, their backgrounds, families, prior careers, divorces, bankruptcies, all the dirt. We review every decision and can predict the outcome of almost every case on appeal. We track every legislature and keep up with bills that might affect civil justice. We also monitor important civil trials.
How about the one in Hattiesburg?
Oh, yes. We were not at all surprised at the verdict.
Then why were my lawyers surprised?
Your lawyers were good, but not great. Plus, the plaintiff has a better case. I've studied a lot of toxic dumps, and Bowmore is one of the worst.
So we'll lose again.
That's my prediction. The flood is coming. Carl glanced at the ocean and drank some more coffee. What happens on appeal? Depends on who's on the Mississippi Supreme Court. Right now, there's a very good chance the verdict will be affirmed in a 5-4 decision. The state has been notoriously sympathetic to plaintiffs for the past 2 decades, and as you probably know, has a well-earned reputation as a hotbed of litigation. Asbestos, tobacco, fen-fen, all sorts of crazy class actions. Tort lawyers love the place. So I'll lose by 1 vote? More or less. The court is not entirely predictable, but yes, it's usually a 5-4 split.
So all we need is a friendly judge.
Yes. Carl placed his cup on a table and shot to his feet. He slid out of his jacket, hung it over a chair, then walked to the windows and stared at the ocean. A cargo ship inched along a mile out, and he watched it for several minutes. Barry slowly sipped his coffee.
"Do you have a judge in mind?" Carl finally asked.
Barry hit the remote. The screen went blank, then disappeared into the ceiling. He stretched as if he had a sore back, then said,
"Perhaps we should talk business first."
Carl nodded and took his chair.
"Let's hear it."
"Our proposal goes something like this. You hire our firm, the money gets wired into the proper accounts, then I will give you a plan for restructuring the Supreme Court of Mississippi."
"How much?"
"There are 2 fees. First, $1 million as a retainer. This is all properly reported. You officially become our client, and we provide consulting services in the area of government relations, a wonderfully vague term that covers just about anything. The second fee is $7 million, and we take it offshore. Some of this will be used to fund the campaign, but most will be preserved. Only the first fee goes on the books." Carl was nodding, understanding. "For $8 million, I can buy myself a Supreme Court justice."
"That's the plan. And this judge earns how much a year?"
$110,000.
$110,000, Carl repeated.
"It's all relative. Your mayor in New York City spent $75 million to get elected to a job that pays a tiny fraction of that. It's politics."
"Politics,"
Carl said as if he wanted to spit. He sighed heavily and slumped an inch or two in his chair.
"I guess it's cheaper than a verdict."
"Much cheaper. And there will be more verdicts. $8 million is a bargain."
"You make it sound so easy."
"It's not. These are bruising campaigns, but we know how to win them.
I want to know how the money is spent. I want the basic plan."
Barry walked over and replenished his coffee from a silver thermos. Then he walked to his magnificent windows and gazed out at the Atlantic. Carl glanced at his watch. He had a 12:30 tea time at the Palm Beach Country Club, not that it mattered that much. He was a social golfer who played because he was expected to play. Reinhardt drained his cup and returned to his chair.
"The truth, Mr. Trudeau, is that you really don't want to know how the money is spent. You want to win. You want a friendly face on the Supreme Court so that when Baker versus Crane Chemical is decided in 18 months, you'll be certain of the outcome. That's what you want. That's what we deliver."
"For $8 million, I would certainly hope so." "You blew 18 on a bad piece of sculpture 3 nights ago, Barry thought, but wouldn't dare say. "You have 3 jets that cost $40 million each. Your renovation in the Hamptons will set you back at least $10 million. And these are just a few of your toys. We're talking business here, not toys." Barry's file on Carl was much thicker than Carl's file on Barry. But then, in fairness, Mr. Reinhardt worked hard to avoid attention, while Mr. Trudeau worked even harder to attract it. It was time to close the deal, so Barry quietly pressed on.
"Mississippi has its judicial elections 1 year from now, next November. We have plenty of time, but none to waste. Your timing is convenient and lucky.
As we slug it out through the election next year, the case plods along through the appellate process. Our new man will take office 1 year from January, and about 4 months later we'll come face to face with Baker versus Crane Chemical." For the first time, Carl saw a flash of the car salesman, and it didn't bother him at all. Politics was a dirty business, where the winners were not always the cleanest guys in town.
One had to be a bit of a thug to survive. My name cannot be at risk, he said sternly. Barry knew he had just collected another handsome fee. It's impossible, he said with a fake smile. We have firewalls everywhere. If one of our operatives gets out of line, does something wrong, we make sure another guy takes the fall. Troy Hogan has never even been remotely tarnished, and if they can't catch us, they damn sure can't find you. No paperwork. Only for the initial fee. We are, after all, a legitimate consulting and government relations firm. We will have an official relationship with you. Consulting, marketing, communications, all those wonderfully nebulous words that hide everything else. But the offshore arrangement is completely confidential. Carl thought for a long time, then smiled and said, I like it. I like it a lot.
Chapter 9. The law office of F. Clyde Hardin and Associates had no associates. It was just Clyde and Miriam, his feeble secretary, who outranked him because she had been there for over 40 years, far longer than Clyde. She had typed deeds and wills for his father, who came home from the Second War without a leg and was famous for removing his wooden one in front of juries to distract them. The old man was gone now, long gone, and he had bequeathed his old office and old furniture and old secretary to his only child, Clyde, who was 54 and very old himself. The Hardin Law Office had been a fixture on Main Street in Bowmore for over 60 years. It had survived wars, depressions, recessions, sit-ins, boycotts, and desegregation, but Clyde wasn't so sure it could survive Crane Chemical. The town was drying up around him. The nickname Cancer County was simply too much to overcome. From his ringside seat, he had watched merchants and cafes and country lawyers and country doctors throw in the towel and abandon the town. Clyde never wanted to be a lawyer, but his father gave him no choice, and though he survived on deeds and wills and divorces, and though he managed to appear reasonably happy and colorful with his seersucker suits, paisley bow ties, and straw hats, he silently loathed the law and the small-town practice of it. He despised the daily grind of dealing with people too poor to pay him, of hassling with other deadbeat lawyers trying to steal said clients, of bickering with judges and clerks, and just about everybody else who crossed his path. There were only 6 lawyers left in Bowmore, and Clyde was the youngest. He dreamed of retiring to a lake or a beach, anywhere, but those dreams would never come true. Clyde had sugared coffee and one fried egg at 8:30 every morning at Babe's, 7 doors to the right of his office, and a grilled cheese and iced tea every noon at Bob's Burgers, 7 doors to the left. At 5 every afternoon, as soon as Miriam had tidied up her desk and said goodbye, Clyde pulled out the office bottle and had a vodka on the rocks. He normally did this alone, in the solitude of the day, his finest hour. He cherished the stillness of his own little happy hour. Often the only sounds were the swishing of a ceiling fan and the rattling of his ice cubes. He had had 2 sips, gulps really, and the booze was beginning to glow somewhere in his brain when there was a rather aggressive knock on his door. No one was expected. Downtown was deserted by 5 every afternoon, but there was the occasional client looking for a lawyer. Clyde was too broke to ignore the traffic. He placed his tumbler on a bookshelf and walked to the front. A well-dressed gentleman was waiting. He introduced himself as Sterling Bitch, or something of that order. Clyde looked at his business card. Bentz, Sterling Bentz, attorney at law from Philadelphia, PA. Mr. Bentz was about 40 years old, short and thin, intense, with the smugness that Yankees can't help but exude when they venture into decaying towns of the Deep South. How could anyone live like this? Their smirks seemed to ask. Clyde disliked him immediately, but he also wanted to return to his vodka, so he offered Sterling a cocktail. Sure, why not? They settled around Clyde's desk and began to drink. After a few minutes of boring chit-chat, Clyde said,
Why don't you get to the point?
Certainly. The accent was sharp and crisp and oh so grating. My firm specializes in class actions for mass torts. That's all we do.
And you're suddenly interested in our little town? What a surprise.
Yes, we are interested. Our research tells us that there may be over 1,000 potential cases around here, and we'd like to sign up as many as possible. But we need local counsel.
You're a bit late, bud. The ambulance chasers have been combing this place for the past 5 years.
Yes, I understand that most of the death cases have been secured, but there are many other types. We'd like to find those victims with liver and kidney problems, stomach lesions, colon trouble, skin diseases, as many as a dozen other afflictions, all caused, of course, by Crane Chemical. We screen them with our doctors, and when we have a few dozen, we hit Crane with a class action. This is our specialty. We do it all the time. The settlement could be huge. Clyde was listening, but pretending to be bored.
Go on,
he said. Crane's been kicked in the crotch. They cannot continue to litigate, so they'll eventually be forced to settle. If we have the first class action, we're in the driver's seat.
We?
Yes. My firm would like to associate with your firm.
You're looking at my firm.
We'll do all the work. We need your name as local counsel and your contacts and presence here in Beaumont.
How much?
Clyde was known to be rather blunt. No sense mincing words with this little shyster from up north. $500 per client, then 5% of the fees when we settle. Again, we do all the work. Clyde rattled his ice cubes and tried to do the math. Sterling pressed on. The building next door is vacant.
Oh, yes. There are many vacant buildings here in Beaumont.
Who owns the one next door?
I do. It's part of this building. My grandfather bought it 1,000 years ago. I got one across the street, too. Empty.
The office next door is the perfect place for a screening clinic. We fix it up, give it a medical ambiance, bring in our doctors, then advertise like hell for anyone who thinks he or she might be sick. They'll flock in. We sign them up, get the numbers, then file a massive action in federal court. It had the distinct ring of something fraudulent. But Clyde had heard enough about mass torts to know that Sterling here knew what he was talking about. 500 clients at $500 a pop, plus 5% when they won the lottery? He reached for the office bottle and refilled both glasses.
Intriguing, Clyde said.
It could be very profitable.